Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on wherever you are in the world. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. This is the first webinar from the U.S. offices of Nishit Desai Associates. I am Mihir Parikh from Silicon Valley office of Nishit Desai in Palo Alto, California. As you may know, Nishit Desai Associates is a research-based, India-centric international law firm. We specialize in Indian law, focusing mostly on complex cross-border legal and regulatory issues. Our core competencies are in international tax, corporate and securities, intellectual property, dispute resolution, regulatory and public policy. In the coming months, we'll be running a series of webinars from our two offices in the U.S., one in New York and another in Silicon Valley in Palo Alto, California. While we regularly offer webinars from our other offices world over, this webinar series is designed especially for companies, investors, and law firms in the U.S. In this webinar, we will be focusing on their specific issues and at time that is convenient for them. We will be hosting subject matter experts and practice leaders from our other offices in Mumbai, Bangalore, Delhi, Singapore, and Munich. Occasionally, we will also host external experts and industry leaders, as these speakers can share with us their insights on the specific topic and practical considerations based on the decades of experience they have in working with companies, regulators, clients, and others. However, please remember, these webinars are only for informational purposes. For any specific advice related to your specific situation, you should approach and get guidance from appropriate professional. After this webinar, we have two other webinars coming up scheduled in April. One on April 10, in which we will discuss regulations related to privacy and data protection. Another one on April 24, in which we will discuss the growth and issues in fast emerging fintech industry in India. For all our webinars, detailed invites will be sent in advance. For US attorney participating in this webinar, we have applied for MCLE credit with the state bars of California and New York. If you wish to receive credit, you must be registered for this webinar, and please send an email to Lynette Hirapetian at lynette.h@nishitdesai.com. That is lynette.h@nishitdesai.com. And in your email, please include the code, which is NCOM1903, along with your full name, contact information, and state bar registration number. Again, the code is NCOM1903. So let's get into this webinar. In this webinar, we will review the key issues in the draft e-commerce policy issued last month by the Government of India's Department of Promotion and Industry and Internal Trade. This department was previously known as the Department of Industrial Policy and Promotion, or DIPP, which is responsible for promotion and development measures for the growth of the industrial sector in India. The key issues or the areas of focus in this draft policy are data, infrastructure development, marketplaces, regulatory issues, and export promotion. In our discussion today, we will outline the draft policy and their potential impact from the strategic, legal, regulatory, and tax perspective. We will discuss how companies and investors having business with India are affected by this policy. We will also discuss FDI regulations governing e-commerce in India and look at related tax considerations, especially for private equity. Joining with me in this webinar are my colleagues Vaibhav Parikh from New York office, Gauri Gokhale from Mumbai office, Pradibha Jain from our Delhi office, Varsha Bhattacharya from our New York office, and I am Mihir Parikh from Palo Alto office. Quickly look at the webinar agenda. After this introduction, for the next 40-45 minutes, we will do the presentation and discussion by the speakers. Then last 10 minutes are reserved for Q&A with webinar participants. If you have any questions, please send them through the chat feature on WebEx, or you can email them to lynette.hirapetian@nishitdesai.com or lynette.h@nishitdesai.com at any time during the webinar. If you are connected through Chorus Call, you can press star on your phone to join the queue for questions and wait till we open the line for Q&A. So thank you again for joining us. Let's start with the webinar. First, I want to give little background and context on this. At Nishit Desai Associates, we always first look at strategic, social and ethical issues related to any policy, and then we develop our legal, regulatory and tax consideration based on strategic aspects. For example, 17 years ago, in 2002, when e-commerce was in nascent stage in India, we convened a group of technology leaders, tax experts, lawyers and academics from all over the world, from the USA, from UK, Germany, the Netherlands, Australia, Singapore, Malaysia, and India, and including from companies like Microsoft, IBM, GE, Wipro, and associations like NASCOM, IBDF, Baker McKenzie, a law firm, Bond University, University of London, etc. In this research study, we undertook an extensive research and identified 28 different models in e-commerce. I'm showing on the graphics some of this material, if you can see on the video. What we did for each of these 28 models, we compared views of regulators from different jurisdictions regarding taxing e-commerce. And as a group, we also provided our view and recommendation to promote growth in e-commerce sector. So e-commerce is close to our heart for over two decades now. We have done a lot of research and studies because we believe that every new technology, business model, financial instrument, and social innovation have strategic, social, ethical, and environmental consideration. If one understands these considerations, one can understand the view of all stakeholders and then develop more appropriate strategy for long-term growth, increasing the value for his or her own company. So let's start first with the strategic aspect of this policy that government has introduced. There are three strategic objectives for draft e-commerce policy. The first objective is controlling the e-commerce sector. So government wants to create a regulatory environment for e-commerce sector under which it can look at the registration of e-commerce entity, importation of goods, anti-counterfeiting and anti-privacy measures, ratings and reviews, authenticity on e-commerce, and consumer grievance management. So a lot of aspects related to e-commerce sector can be properly regulated. Government wants to safeguard interests of consumer, especially related to data ownership and data sharing. Government also wants to leverage the access to data for all sizes of entities, whether it's a large companies or whether it's a small player in e-commerce sector, and also wants to impose special restrictions for cross-border data flow. The next objective for government is protect domestic player. Government wants to empower domestic players against first movers advantage, especially from the large companies in e-commerce, data services, or digital infrastructure space. It wants to enhance skills and technological empowerment of micro, small, and medium-sized enterprises, vendors, and traders involved in e-commerce. It wants to foster homegrown service provider and facilitate export through e-commerce by reducing administrative requirements and costs. And the third objective is to build local capability. Government wants to give infrastructure status to technologies and installation involved in e-commerce in order to create digital capabilities and digital infrastructure in India. It also wants to promote domestic research and digital innovation, and while ensure that domestic players are sustainable in digital economy. So with these three objectives in mind, who are influenced or affected strategically by this policy? Obviously, e-commerce companies are mostly affected. They include online retailers, marketplaces, platforms, whether public or membership-based private platforms, online auction sites. However, if you look closely, the sphere of influence is much wider and affects many other groups. For example, digital infrastructure providers, which include data services, cloud services, data storage, logistics and fulfillment services, which include delivery services, couriers, warehouses, distribution centers, payment platforms, which include payment gateways, payment services, banking services, and marketing and advertisement services, which includes very wide variety of companies which have search engines, social media, content aggregator. So if you are with companies or invested involved in any of these groups, it is very important that you understand the implications of this draft e-commerce policy, as they can affect the compliance liability, your growth potential, your exit opportunity, as well as valuation of your company. So let's look into more detailed nuances of e-commerce draft policy, starting with FDI aspect. So I'm handing over to Vaibhav Parikh to discuss FDI regulations governing e-commerce.
Thank you, Mihir. So before we go into the draft e-commerce policy, let's look at what are the existing regulations on FDI governing e-commerce. Mir, next slide. If you see, just to give you a historical context, right? FDI was permitted in wholesale cash and carry, and FDI was prohibited in retail trading. This is how it started. Government had then permitted FDI in B2B e-commerce companies and prohibited FDI in B2C e-commerce companies, because what government thought that B2B is like wholesale cash and carry and B2C is more like retail trading. So let's prohibit that. Around the same time, government also permitted technology platforms technology platform for connecting buyers and sellers. In particularly, Bazi in 1999-2000 was one of the earliest case, which was later on acquired by eBay. So that became a precedent in the mind of government that FDI in technology platforms are permitted. Somewhere around 2008 onwards, a lot of e-commerce models which ended up becoming popular. One of the popular model was where government, where model looked at it and says, look, since we all need FDI, why don't we divide the activities into one sector where FDI is permitted and the other sector where FDI is not permitted. So basically, the activity is divided where wholesale cash and carry. So you had a FDI entity which had which was wholesale cash and carry, which actually sold goods to the vendor. Then vendor used that particular goods to sell it to the marketplace, which again was owned by the same FDI entity. And that marketplace also provided different services, including payment related services, logistic services, consumer services, etc. So in essence, they divided this whole e-commerce selling into multiple parts, and where FDI was permitted, they ended up putting it out in a other separate entity, and where it was prohibited, which was very small part, which is buying it from a wholesaler and then selling it to end customers, was kept aside in a entity where it did not have any FDI investment. And at that point of time, since there were no restrictions, those entities were generally held by Indian founders or relatives of founders, etc. Then there was a revision in law, and then certain restrictions started coming on the back end side and the front end side, and also a group company concept came into picture. And because of that particular restrictions, there was a change in the structure where the retail entity ended up having a different structure than it was earlier. Around same time, there was a relaxation on multi-brand retail and single brand retail. Will not get into that, but it was first time when government, first time in 2016 when government actually took and came up with comprehensive regulations on marketplace, where they connected the wholesale cash and carry, the technology platforms, as well as the other services, and came with detailed regulations. That regulations underwent changes. And the most recent one was in end of 2018. It's called Press Note 2 of 2018. And we will be discussing that in our discussion today. Next slide, Mihir. If you see the discussion, if you see the regulation, the regulation permitted, so first of all, they permitted, if you are a manufacturer in India, then you can actually go out and sell on e-commerce. If you were single brand retail trading, then as long as you had a brick and mortar company, then you can go and sell on e-commerce. But other than these two, only marketplace was permitted with certain condition. Inventory-based model, e-commerce model, was prohibited. So FDI was prohibited in inventory-based e-commerce model. If you really look at the conditions which were put on marketplace-based model, some were relatively easy conditions. It's not difficult to really comply with. First of all, they could provide services, but they could not provide warranty or guarantee on behalf of seller. It was responsibility of only the seller. Similarly, they had to provide names, address, and other details on the website of the seller. They could facilitate sales, but they were subject to RBI conditions. So those kind of things were slightly easier to follow. Then there were certain other conditions which actually were further modified by Press Note 2 of 2018. And that's something which we'll discuss. Mir, can you go to the next slide, please? So if you look at those conditions, there were four critical conditions which came on in board. The first important condition was a restriction on a vendor selling in a marketplace if that vendor had a equity participation either directly or through his group company. In this situation, two things became critical. First, what is equity participation, right? Does it mean that if vendor had equity from a marketplace, then it was prohibited? But what if it had equity, or what if it had preference shares or convertible debentures in the marketplace? Will it also be considered to be equity? That became a question. So if you had equity participation, or in our view, if you have a convertible instrument which converts into equity, then it is considered to be a situation where vendor cannot sell on the marketplace. Now, so that is something which is clear, but the more complex aspect of the definition was, it says a direct or through group company. And then further, group company was defined as either owning 26% of voting control in the company, or having ability to appoint more than 50% directors in the company. Now, when you look at this definition of group company, the first question comes is whether there is a sister company is covered, which means that if a marketplace is not investing, but what if a sister company of marketplace is investing in a vendor? In which case would it be covered by the definition of a group company, right? We believe, since it has a concept of directly and indirectly, when it defines the control of 26% or ability to appoint 50% of the directors, we believe that that particular thing can be covered under a definition of a group company. But then it came next question: what if a company which is investing in vendor has only or has less than 26% voting rights, but has non-voting rights or non-voting equity in that particular entity which has invested in vendor? So that became a question. And if you look at it, the definition, technically speaking, as long as the vendor does not have any investment from entity which is a group company, that vendor can sell. As long as the entity which has invested in vendor would not be a group company if it does not have 26% or more than, or 26% of voting control or ability of appointing 50% or more director by the marketplace. So if you really look at those concepts, what it means is that a vendor, as long as its parent company or any of its parent company, or grandparent or anyone else, as long as they don't have more than 26% voting rights by marketplace or its group company, it will not be a group company. And because it won't be a group company, it will have an ability, vendor will have ability to sell on the marketplace. It means that you can go beyond 26% when it comes to non-voting equity shares or non-voting quasi-equity shares. So this is something which is an interesting aspect which we are seeing now in the market. The next point is that, look, if a marketplace can have 26% voting rights, can it have 76% of non-voting rights in the company? The answer really is no, because sorry, if marketplace has 26% voting rights, can they have 100% of economic rights? The answer really no, because the moment it hits more than 49%, there are indirect downstream investment guidelines which hits, and because of which the maximum equity investment which can be made by marketplace or his group company in the parent of the vendor is limited to 49%. The second aspect which comes is control over inventory. Again, here there is a deemed control if more than 25% of purchasers or vendors are from marketplace entity or his group companies. So this particular provision was brought in to prevent a marketplace or group company or marketplace to sell to their wholesale vendor venture to goods to vendor, and then vendor goes and sells it on marketplace. In this particular situation, if you really look at it, if you have a market, if you have a wholesale cash and carry which is selling goods to the vendor, but if it is less than 26% owned by voting rights owned by marketplace or his group company, and has 100% economic rights, it will still not be a group company, and technically it may be possible for vendor to sell. Also, if you really look at it, if a marketplace which is a wholesale cash and carry which is you know, controlled by marketplace, if they sell it to unrelated party, unrelated wholesaler, and then wholesaler goes and sells it to the vendor who then sells it on the marketplace, that also is not covered by the current restrictions. Now, while these are ways in which one will see how the business comes up, but you will need to look everything in a holistic perspective when you see whether it is in compliance with law or not. The last aspect is with respect to influence of sale and you know, have maintain a level playing field, and also on services and cashback. Now, if you really look at this particular policy, what it says is that, look, it has to be on arm's length basis and on non-discriminatory manner. This is wide, this is not defined, and really speaking, this can be one challenge itself, can be done under constitution law, whether it is vague or not. Second, since it is wide, it can be interpreted in multiple manner, and hence it needs to be carefully looked at whenever a marketplace is providing any services or cashback, on what exactly circumstances they are providing this cashback or services. As long as the circumstances are not similar, they are able to differentiate. So in our view, if you are providing a cashback or a service in certain terms in one category, then for other category, you can have different terms or cashback for the other category. So this is something which may be possible. But again, we need to look from holistic perspective. And lastly, there was no, you can't have an exclusive arrangement, which again was not a, a big issue in this to start with. Mihir, next slide, please. If you see the this particular notification when it came in 2016, it also brought in services under the ambit of e-commerce marketplace. Now, if you are looking at FDI in services, it was something which was always permissible. It was not something which was prohibited. But because the e-commerce services has been brought up, there are certain conditions which are applicable. Even on e-commerce services industry. And this is something to be kept in mind when any investment is coming in an e-commerce company which is providing services, a marketplace. Also, we are seeing, Amir, next slide, please. We are also seeing litigations around this area, and we will see more and more litigation. Currently, the litigation which we are seeing is mainly with respect to control and influence of sale price, and this is something where, as we understand from the court, ED is already investigating some companies. So we will see a lot of activity and litigation in this particular field, specifically because the words are quite broad and little ambiguous. With this, I hand over to Gauri to discuss aspects of draft e-commerce policy.
Thank you, Mihir, and thank you, Vaibhav. Mihir, could we go on to the next slide, please?
Sure.
So I think Mihir has already laid out, the outline of the policy, the possible impact of the policy. But I'll just take a step back and sort of articulate what do we mean by this, what is the intent of this policy, right? So if we really see during last few years, the government has really gone ahead and looked into various sectors, especially affecting the digital economy and overall TMT sector. So you had telecom policy being introduced, Digital India policy being introduced. Recently, it has also announced the broadcast policy, and now we have the e-commerce policy. So unlike FDI policy, which is actually an implementable law, most of the other policies I mentioned are more of an intent document. That means it just gives the direction to the various arms of the government so that the legislature, judiciary, and the executive have a certain direction as to how the government is envisaging a particular sector to develop within India. So this particular policy has a similar impact. It doesn't have the force of law, even when it is finally announced. As Mihir explained, it has various facets that have been handled within this particular policy. While I will deal with the nitty-gritties of the policy, I will try to deal with it at least the salient features. But my colleague Pratibha will be later dealing as to why this particular policy came in and the way forward. So I will park that point for her, but jump directly into the policy. So what has happened is, apart from this particular policy that we are noticing, there are several other developments on the side that we have noticed, which are equally important and have to be looked into holistically with this policy. So we have a separate data protection law, which is probably on the lines of GDPR, at least at the current stage, is being looked into by the government. As Mihir mentioned, that this particular policy has a lot of importance given to the data economy as a whole. Then we have a separate issue coming up because, of course, with the elections around the corner, a lot of importance in relation to fake news, and because of that, the entire intermediary regime was being looked into separately. And the third development, of course, on the security side, because of the data leak and other incidences, the government is really concerned about the security issues. And therefore, you will notice that in this policy, it's a mixed bag. You will find all these elements sort of combined into this policy, and that's why it's creating some amount of confusion. And the reason I say confusion is because you do have a data protection bill which is under consideration by the government, and then you have this policy which is trying to sort of override that particular entire process. And that is the reason we thought that we will have a separate webinar on the data issue altogether, but today we will at least give some highlights as a trailer maybe. Now jumping into the specifics, what I will do is I will first focus more on the intermediary aspect, and I'll tell you why it becomes important. Mihir, next slide. The reason intermediary aspect becomes important is if you see the definition, which is almost mirroring most of the international definitions, whether in the treaties or even the other legislations in other countries. So basically, as we have noticed, most of the economies are moving to more of platform economy, right? You have marketplaces, you have cloud providers, you have PaaS, SaaS models coming up. Accounting software coming up, so basically all this economy being the platform economy, the importance on the intermediary concept as a whole, and as traditionally most of us will remember that intermediary always got a safe harbor. So initially, of course we had several countries in which some liabilities were imposed on the intermediaries, but then the concept developed that the intermediary should get safe harbor if they follow certain guidelines. So we under Indian law also have this particular concept. And why is it becoming, you know, important in the context of the e-commerce policy? Because you will notice that lot of importance has been given as to how the intermediaries should behave or what should be their obligations, what should be their, you know, processes. So I will deal with those aspects, and around that we also have certain court judgments coming up and the Ministry of Information Technology also looking at the intermediary liability issues. So I will deal with all of them together holistically so that we see the clear picture. At the moment, we do have a definition, but I think one doesn't realize, you know, unless we start looking into the nitty-gritties, that this particular definition is very, very wide, and the cloud providers and all the, you know, other stakeholders that I mentioned all fall within this bucket. So when the government looks at intermediary or marketplace and tries to impose certain obligations, unfortunately, everybody is treated at the same, you know, in the same sort of bucket, without realizing that each one will have a different obligations impact on the consumer, on the businesses, etc. So today we are facing that kind of difficulty, and in fact, we were involved in industry consultation for the new, you know, intermediary guidelines as well, and we realized that, you know, this particular issue is going to impact several of the intermediaries, and therefore, you know, some importance should be given to this particular area. So quickly, dealing with the intermediaries which basically host data to be viewed publicly, you do have certain provisions for takedown, which are almost similar to the provisions in other countries. Interestingly, in India, there was a particular Supreme Court judgment called Shreya Singhal, where the Supreme Court said that the intermediaries are not required to take cognizance of illegal content on their own or even by the notice by a general public, but only when it is given notice by the court or a relevant government department is it required to take down content. So that was a good sort of, you know, precedent, because otherwise, intermediaries would get inundated by several takedown notices, right? So they were not mandated to do so, to take down unless and until government or court orders. In the proposed amendment, however, very interesting, when I say proposed amendment, this I'm meaning to the intermediary guidelines and not so much in the e-commerce policy. But what is intended is that they should have a technology deployment which will basically identify, illegal content, unlawful content, and on its own takedown. Now, this is going to be a very, very onerous obligation, and a lot is being discussed to say that it may actually affect freedom of speech and expression, because technology may not necessarily, be able to distinguish between what is the freedom of speech and expression protected content versus unprotected, right? So this is going to create a lot of anxiety. It is creating anxiety in the particular sector. And as I said, currently this will apply to any and every intermediary, and that is where another difficulty that will come in. Mihir, next slide.
Yeah.
Then if we see the e-commerce policy, now these are the provisions which are being discussed in the e-commerce policy. So just to take a step back and, you know, deal with some of these aspects which are very important in a digital economy is, of course, the IP protection, right? So a lot of content companies are sort of facing difficulty, of course, in so far as the infringing websites are not necessarily hosted out from India, but hosted from outside India, and putting up infringing content. And Indian government, Indian judiciary, Indian police authorities are having difficulty to nab these infringers because they are located outside India. So this was one bothering issue, for the government. And the e-commerce policy basically has laid out certain interesting provisions for how the rogue websites could be identified, what should be the process followed for taking down infringing content, etc. So that some amount of work has already happened in Maharashtra, which is state of Maharashtra, and Mumbai cybercrime has done a lot of good work in this particular space, and we can see a reflection of that in the policy. The next issue that arises also is about counterfeit products, and there has been a lot of a lot of complaints being filed in relation to counterfeit products. And there you will find even the pharmaceutical counterfeit products, cosmetic counterfeit products, which really would affect public health as well. So in that particular context, again, you have a court judgment, which is, different court judgments that have come up, where they have sort of identified when does an intermediary could be still held liable because they have given, reps and warranties. As Vaibhav was mentioning, technically marketplaces are not supposed to be giving reps and warranties, but if they do give that reps and warranty, then when do they get liable, when not, etc. So the draft policy also discusses the process that should be followed to protect counterfeits from being sold on the website, and of course the fake news related aspects, which are being separately handled by the Ministry of Information Technology. And the last bucket being objectionable content. So just to summarize, the e-commerce policy, draft policy, has some good provisions in relation to that. The only balancing act that will be required, that intermediaries should not be too overburdened, with the processes that they technically cannot, on their own implement. So that is a balance that will be brought up, required to be brought out. The next one, I will not deal with too much in detail, but the draft guidelines have added certain aspects insofar as due diligence to be undertaken by these intermediaries. The last aspect, which is very important, is the security obligation. So the draft e-commerce policy also recognizes that this entire digital economy as a whole will create certain security or has already created certain security concerns, and therefore what should be the approach. And the proposed intermediary guidelines do deal with some aspects which are currently being debated because they sort of are overbroad and do not necessarily protect the Indian citizens from the government action. So there should be some balancing act that will happen. Otherwise, the contemplation is that any government department can approach an intermediary, and we do get these queries quite often by different levels of intermediaries that we have received this government request, we have received this police request, how should we go about handling that particular request, right? So this particular aspect also, we will see some development, and probably, maybe in next 2 or 3 months, we may see the final guidelines that may sort of be established along with the e-commerce policy. Mihir, next slide.
Yeah.
So, coming to data now. So as I mentioned, we do already have a data protection bill. So I will not on the data protection aspect of it, and for which we will have a separate webinar, but just to quickly tell you, it is current position is almost 90% to 95% GDPR. So those of you who have already implemented GDPR, what we will really need to do is a gap analysis and then implement. This particular law is maybe about 2 or 3 years away from actual implementation. Again, it is currently only in the draft stage, likely to be put before the cabinet after the elections, after which it may go to the parliamentary committee. So that's the quick update, and then you will have about 2 years like you have had under GDPR to sort of implement that particular law. So more on that in our next webinar. But the other important aspect insofar as the policy is concerned, what you will notice in the policy is it is trying to sort of almost override the particular process on the data as a whole, and it is coming out with certain concepts which are again beyond the data protection bill. So I hope in the next draft, at least we see dilution on that, and the government will realize that let the data protection bill do its job and the policy should not intervene on that. However, couple of other important aspects which are very peculiar that are coming out, and it shows how the government is thinking, is that government is trying to show as if they are supposed to be sort of controlling the data of the Indian citizens. So on the one hand, you have a Supreme Court judgment which last year recognized privacy as a fundamental right of Indian citizens and also recognized that the data should be owned by each individual. So whereas the government is trying to say that I'm going to control how the data should be handled, where the data should be located, where whether it should be transferred outside India or not, whether some companies can make use of outside India can make use of that data or not. So all these elements, unfortunately, I think the policy is going slightly all over the place insofar as these issues are concerned, and which are slightly concerning. But we hope that, with industry consultation, etc., somewhere we see a balanced approach coming out of this. But yes, there is some concern insofar as whether or not, number one, security concern, number two, whether Indian companies will be able to really capitalize on the Indian data or not, and number three, whether if the data is located outside India, whether it will have the Indian data may be compromised or not. So some of these areas will have to be addressed. The next quick thing that the draft e-commerce policy talks about is any foreign entity wants to do business in India, and that is coming out of in the draft intermediary guidelines as well. That they are looking at foreign companies to establish local presence. Now, that is little concerning in our mind, because then that means, companies which are smaller companies not wanting to expand, their operations across different countries, wanting to do businesses, from maybe a single location or two locations, may be required to mandatorily establish Indian local presence. So that seems to be the theme coming out of different, policies, as I said, and we will need to wait and watch as to where this sort of heads to. But it may create some tax concerns as well. Maybe Varsha, maybe dealing with those aspects. But this is one concerning aspect being discussed in this particular draft policy. Mihir, quickly next slide, and I will wrap up in a minute. The next one, as I mentioned, is I think localization I've discussed, but I quite a few good sort of suggestions coming out more from ease of doing business. So we are in the last few years, we have seen a lot of interesting models coming up for export and import of goods and services. And a lot of questions are coming up in those models as to how the payments should flow, how the data should flow, how the goods and services should flow. So, and especially the documentation, we do have exchange control regulations, which sort of control the remittances from India. So all these elements are creating some amount of interesting work for the lawyers, but I think it is a lot needs to be done in this space for ease of doing business. And the draft policy has recognized this need and has given some good suggestions. If anybody is interested in, you can probably see last two chapters of the policy in relation to this. And again, quick update on the payment infrastructure also. Government has set up its own infrastructure. It has gone ahead and set up its own app, payment app. So a lot you will see, developing, which again, we are going to discuss in our next webinar on FinTech. And of course, government is wanting to enhance the e-governance as well, and has suggested some interesting AI tools to be deployed for e-governance in this policy. So I'll hand it over back, Mihir, to you and maybe Pratibha.
Sure. So absolutely, this is great, Gauri, Vaibhav. Thank you. Next, Pratibha, what is next? What is government thinking? If you can shed some light, it would be really very helpful. Pratibha?
Sure. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
So I think before I jump into where do we see this going, I think it's important to understand why these changes, which we've seen in the last couple of months, were brought out, and what is the intent behind it. I think, unless we understand that, some of this can be very confusing. And also, just sitting in Delhi, what we see being written in press and, what we hear from people from outside India talking about what the intent of the policy is, there seems to be a wide gap. Let me first talk about what has publicly been said about why these changes have been brought about and why the draft policy has been introduced. The number one reason that's been provided, if you see the newspapers, was that the small traders were complaining, especially about the portals providing deep discounts and them not having a level playing field. However, if it was literally one organization that was bringing this up, and you know, we tried to find if they had any small trader members, and we couldn't even find that detail. And if that was the case, the changes wouldn't have been made in the FDI policy. It would have been applicable both to domestic and foreign entities, which was not the case. The change was brought about. The actual change, other than what the current draft policy is, was brought about only in the FDI regulations governing foreign investors. Second reason provided was the WTO negotiations that the India and some of the other countries were being pushed into accepting a permanent moratorium on imposing custom duties for electronic transmissions. And again, you know, to see the relationship between that and you know, domestic e-commerce policy seemed like a stretch. I think the two other reasons seem more plausible and are related. One is just promoting the domestic Indian companies and reaction to the growing power of some of the big global foreign entities doing business in India in this space. But unfortunately, I think, and I think the government's realizing this now, consequence of the change in the regulations was promotion of only on the big companies in India, and actually to the detriment of the Indian startups. And for that purpose, you know, I think the government's realizing that it was probably a knee-jerk reaction, that they didn't think through the unintended consequences that it might have, especially for funding for Indian startups. Some of the questions that, you know, we've raised in our interactions with the government, and we know various industry bodies that we are members of have raised with the Indian government, are around, A, how will the Indian startups get funded? If you look at last 2 years, estimated $29 billion that's gone into investments in the venture capital space, so investments in startups, only about $600 million estimated has gone in from the domestic funding sources. The rest of it is from the foreign investors. And whenever we have regulatory changes that are sudden, like the one we had, literally companies had a month and a few days extra to implement the changes that had been proposed in the FDI policy, that leads to reducing confidence by foreign investors who look for certainty in their regulations in the countries that they're investing in. It also has increased cost of compliance for Indian startups looking to be the next unicorns. And it, like I mentioned before, promotes only the big domestic companies and seemingly at the cost of the Indian startups. And in that sense, it's actually anti-competitive in nature and in contradiction to the spoken policy of the government to promote competition in this space. That's just to provide a background of what's happening and what the consequences of this is, which the government's aware of. So the draft e-commerce policy that the government had released, and the last date of submission of comments is actually 2 days from now, which is 29th of this month. What we've been given to understand is that for now the government's going to hold further consultation with the industry on all of these issues, and we're really not expecting the policy to be brought out before the elections, and the consultations also to go on after elections, which is good news because I think from what all Gauri and Weber have already outlined, there's a lot that still needs to be done in this space with respect to ensuring that there is a level playing field for domestic companies and big domestic companies and Indian startups looking for funding by foreign investors. So with that, I think I'll hand it over to Varsha to just talk about the tax consequences.
Yeah, thank you, Pradeva. Varsha, please. Varsha, we can hear you. Go ahead. Is your phone on the mute?
Hi, sorry. Thank you,
okay,
Mihir.
Okay, go ahead. Sure.
Yeah. Mihir, can we go on to the next slide, please?
Sure.
So, touching upon tax consequences of the e-commerce sector and the digital economy, the growth of these sectors have thrown up a lot of new challenges in the face of existing tax rules, not only domestically, but also internationally. One aspect to consider is the implications of these of the new e-commerce policy that we've been discussing so far. And the other aspect to consider are the independent reform measures that are coming in the tax law world, again, at the international level as well as domestically. One of the biggest waves of reform has been the OECD's base erosion and profit shifting project. Over the last 5 to 6 years, the reports have come out on a number of action plans that deal with base erosion that a lot of countries have been dealing with in the past few years. And the very first action plan deals with the digital economy taxation. The final report came out in 2015. It recommended a variety of measures that countries could take in and suggested that countries enter bilateral negotiation or multilateral negotiation to arrive at certain common measures to plug the loopholes that were existent in the law. Now, while we wait for these measures to achieve some kind of international consensus, a lot of countries in a spate of protective measures have gone ahead and brought in unilateral measures to deal with these tax problems in their domestic law while we wait for the international measures to come in. One of these measures that has been brought in by the Indian government is the inclusion of the significant economic presence criterion under the business connection concept. Business connection is essentially a tax nexus concept that allows the Indian government to tax the business income of a non-resident entity in India. Now, the business connection till before was defined in sort of broad terms under the Indian law. However, the inclusion of the significant economic presence concept has widened it a lot further because significant economic presence is a criterion that is based on the number of users or the number of transactions that a non-resident undertakes in the country and not so much on the nature of the role as it has been in the past. Now, significant economic presence is only a criteria under the domestic law. So to the extent that non-residents can avail tax treaty protections, they can seek go under the override that is available under Indian tax law. And where the concept of a permanent establishment under a tax treaty is defined in a narrower form than business connection, a non-resident does not really at this point need to worry about the significant economic presence criterion. So then we come to the permanent establishment concept under tax treaties that is existent right now. As I mentioned earlier, pursuant to the BEPS recommendations, there are going to be a lot of reforms that are going to be brought in to tax treaties going forward. At this point, these amendments have not been brought in any tax treaties under bilateral negotiations. However, under the existing law in India, there is a concept of virtual permanent establishments, which is when a non-resident has a website which is hosted on a server in India, and that server is physically controlled or under the guidance or leased by the non-resident in India, that server can serve as a permanent establishment and an anchor for the Indian authorities to tax. So far, India has had a sort of conflicting jurisprudence on what actually amounts to this kind of a physical anchor for the Indian government to tax. However, it's expected that once the data localization rules are brought into force, this will create additional complications if the non-resident is required to have ownership of the servers in India and to control the way the data is stored in India. Mihir, can we move to the next slide, please?
Sure.
So apart from the nexus of the income to India, which allows India to tax that income, the other way in which India can tax certain streams of income of a non-resident is if that income has a source in India. So incomes like royalty, interest, etc., which are source-based taxed, are taxed in the hands of the non-resident if they come from India and are usually recovered through a withholding tax mechanism. This brings us to the problem of income characterization. So a certain type of income which a non-resident might regard as its business income can be characterized as royalty by the Indian courts. This is because royalty is defined in a very, very broad manner under Indian domestic law compared to tax treaties. Further, there has been a line of jurisprudence in India on copyright versus copyrighted article, which is essentially the difference between purchasing a copyright versus buying an article which has a copyright inbuilt in it. And this is essentially the difference between paying royalty and paying something which is essentially a payment for a good. Additionally, another line of jurisprudence that we can see, which is particularly relevant for e-commerce companies, is the characterization of their business income as royalty because it is seen as payment for access to the software or the platform that the e-commerce company is providing. This risk of recharacterization makes it very, very important for companies to pay attention to how their contracts are worded. These contracts should not read like they're very heavy on the IP itself and use of the IP, but they should be more worded on based on the business model of the entity. Mihir, next slide, please.
Sure.
Just outside the context of income tax, there are two other taxes that I'll briefly touch upon. One is the equalization levy. Equalization levy, again, is one of the recommendations that was made under the BEPS reports. It has been brought in as a unilateral measure by the Indian government in 2016. It is essentially a direct tax outside the income tax regime, which will be levied on non-residents who render services like online advertisement and digital advertising space to Indians. The resident Indian entity is required to deduct this tax and deposit it. This can bring up concerns of the foreign entity getting credit of this tax in their jurisdiction, and it's likely to cause the burden of the tax to shift onto the Indian deductor. Now, the last aspect, Mihir, next slide, please.
Yeah.
The very last thing I'll touch upon is the goods and services tax. The GST regime was brought in to overhaul the indirect tax regime in India in July of 2017. It's been intended to be brought in as a single tax to remove all the multiplicity of indirect taxes we had. Currently, it's imposed as a multiple-tiered rate system with the different classifications of goods. One point on which Pratibha also mentioned was regarding the WTO moratorium on levy of customs duty. The levy of GST on import of intangible goods is contingent on the levy of customs duty, and so far under the moratorium, this customs duty has not been levied. if the moratorium is lifted, then there is a chance that GST will also be imposed on this on import of intangible goods. With that, I conclude the tax portion. Handing over back to you, Mihir.
Yeah, thank you, Varsha. Thank you, everyone. My sincere apologies to all those joinees. Unfortunately, we are out of time, and I'm very much cognizant of time, your time. However, if you have a question, please do send us an email. We'll try our best to answer those. I do see there are a couple of questions already posted. Because we are short on time, we will close now. I just want
maybe
to thank all the speakers. Yes, Vibhav.
No, maybe we can take one or two questions quickly. I know we are late, but if people are there, maybe we can extend it by 5 minutes.
Sure. Just give me 1 minute, and then we can extend it. So I want to thank all the speakers for sharing their insights. I want to thank our people who've been behind the stage, Lynette, Deviani, Mukesh, and our entire IT support and business development support team. And I also want to thank Rio, who is from the Chorus Call, acting as a moderator on the Chorus Call line. So I want to thank all of you. So now we can go back and have questions. So there is one question for Parmeet. Vaibhav, can you read that? I think you might be the one who can who had discussed the press note too. So if you can just look into that and answer.
Yeah, I think the question which I can see from Parmeet is, can PressNote 2 be circumvented by selling stake to third party, for example, high net worth individuals, and then having a separate profit sharing agreement with them, right? So that is what I was saying in my talk. Now, if you really look technically speaking, what the PressNote 2 says is you cannot, if a vendor is buying from a marketplace or its group company, and then he cannot sell it on the marketplace, right? But if the vendor is buying from an unrelated third party, then it doesn't technically violate the guidelines, even though the third party, whether it's high net worth individuals or some other wholesaler, has bought it from the marketplace, right? Now, so if you really look at it, it is outside the, it doesn't violate it, but things are always to looked on a holistic basis. Now, if you add up one more layer where you marketplace or his group company has a profit sharing agreement with that particular, let's say, high network individual, in my mind, this will definitely come up for questioning, because not just then the question will be whether this high network individual actually is acting in his own basis or whether he's acting as a front for the marketplace. And if he's acting as a front for the marketplace, then the high network individual actually is not selling; it is the marketplace which is selling. The PressNote 2 could be considered to be violated. So if you really look at everything, all the facts and circumstances, in my mind, it is perfectly possible for a vendor to buy from a third party as long as the third party is independent and has no relationship whatsoever. Now, it may have happened that third party may have bought it from the wholesale arm of marketplace, that technically should not be an issue. But if there are any premeditated way of circumventing the regulations, and that's the why you're structured in a particular way, then it could be questioned. I hope this answers your point.
Yeah, thank you, Vaibhav. Rio, are there any other question lined up on the Chorus Call?
Let me check. Participants who wish to ask questions may press star and one on your touchtone telephone. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask questions, you may press star and one. We have a question from the line of Nirmal Bansal, who's a student. Please go ahead.
Okay, go ahead, Nirmal.
Hi. So what I wanted to know was that, so Amazon is currently still selling through Apareo Retail on their platform. Even if you check now, and if you check the seller details, you still find that Apareo Retail is selling. But in the first week of one, when the FDI note came in, Apareo Retail wasn't the seller. So do you know, perhaps happen to know what arrangement Amazon is working out to be able to sell through Apareo Retail in which it has significant shares?
No, I don't think we will be able to comment on. Yeah, I don't think
yeah,
we should be
I'm
able
sorry.
To comment on a specific you know, situation.
Okay, thank you so much.
We're subject to client.
Nirmal, there may be some information in media, but that's about all we can talk about. We cannot really discuss in a specific situation. Talk about this. Anybody else? Any other speakers have anything to add? Okay. Rio, anybody else on the line with question?
No, there are no further questions in queue.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, and wish you a wonderful day, evening, night, and look forward to having us join on April 10 for the next webinar, which is on data privacy, localization, very interesting stuff. And again, we'll be getting the best speakers lined up for that. So thank you again for joining, and good night.